Good morning. Buenos dias. And first of all, I'd like to acknowledge my boss is here, so there's no pressure on me right now. Dr. Gracia, and there's other colleagues here like Christine Perez, Region 9, and some folks back there. But it's a pleasure to be here with you. And first of all, I want to congratulate the city of San Francisco. They won the World Series. It was a great game, and it was chaos last night. And I heard the parade is Wednesday. I found out last night that the parade is Wednesday. So I may be able to catch it because I don't know if we'll get back. Is it? Oh, wow.
Does the health authority
sound? Oh, thank you. But, yeah. Anyway, thank you again for giving me the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about some of the work that we're doing at the Office of Minority Health. I'd like to also acknowledge the previous presenters because they did talk a lot about some of the themes that we work on at OMH. And it's interesting, you know, 10 years ago, maybe there would have been one panelist that talked about cultural competence. Now there's three folks. And then you tie in health equity, which is so interconnected with, the cultural competency kind of concepts. So I have no investment in anything, any work that I do. So these are the themes that I'm going to cover this morning. Talk about the mission of OMH. Talk a little bit about health disparities, social determinants that have already been touched upon this morning. Define cultural and linguistically appropriate services in healthcare. Talk about the national class standards and cultural and linguistically appropriate services in health and healthcare. And the intent of the draft, I said draft because they haven't been approved yet at the headquarters. And then talk about the developmental process that we went through in developing the new enhanced standards. We call it the Enhancement Initiative, and then some key components, again, draft, national class standard. All right, and then I'm going to give you some resources I think that may be a help to you for the good work that you're doing in your respective communities. So what is the mission of OMH? Basically, our mission is, we're situated at the Office of the Secretary, so we have a little bit of leverage, a lot of leverage, really, to kind of advise the Secretary, Dr. Gracia, advises the Secretary on health disparities kind of initiatives or the agenda. So whenever there's a sister agency that's launching a particular initiative, we try to make sure that health disparities that affect racial and ethnic minority populations are infused in those particular initiatives. But for us, we also develop policies and initiatives that can help eliminate health disparities that disproportionately affect minority populations. I don't need to tell you who those are, but I think you're all intelligent and well-read individuals that know who I'm talking about. So disparities in America. We know that disparities are having an economic burden on this country. I think earlier some comments were made about the cost, let's say, of, is there any studies that have been done in terms of, if you use certain interventions, or what is the cost in terms of to the economy of this country, because we don't address health disparities, we don't reduce health disparities. There's an excellent study out of Johns Hopkins University, I think it's Dr. Levice, and so if you get a chance, just Google Dr. Levice, Thomas Levice, and there's a study that he did in terms of the economic consequences of how health disparities severely impact not only the lives of minority populations, but the economy of this country. So, and we know in this room, diabetes are very high among minority populations. HIV/AIDS, African Americans, Latino, cardiovascular disease, cancer. But interesting, and I'll go back to diabetes. It's very personal to me because I lost my dad in 1995 because of complications of diabetes. They amputated part of his leg, got gangrene. I was in D.C. and I have eight sisters, by the way. There's 11 of us. And so I get a call from my sister, say, hey, listen, Papa is in the hospital. You know, he's got gangrene. They're going to amputate his leg. You know, his diabetes got out of hand. Boom. Okay, so I fly out of D.C., get here the next day. And sure enough, you know, they amputated his leg. Then talk to the surgeon. He said, well, the probability of him losing his other leg was high because if he doesn't, the surgeon said, if he doesn't watch his diet, he doesn't stop drinking, stop smoking, etc., he's going to lose another leg. We got him into rehab, and, you know, he did okay for a while. And then a year later, boom, embolism, and he's gone like that. Okay. So that's a personal example in terms of how the diabetes affects all of us, either now or in the near future. Because we know that we have increasing rates of obesity, increasing rates of diabetes, and et cetera. So, but this kind of slide gives you an idea in terms of how how health disparities is affecting the lives of not only minority populations, but every American in this country. So we do have a vested interest to address health disparities. So earlier we talked about social determinants of health. And it's my premise, and I think the literature is starting to show that place does matter. Okay, we can't just address health disparities from a healthcare service delivery perspective, because there are other kind of factors or variables that impact someone's well-being. I used to live here in the city, in the Mission, back in the 70s. And some of you who are familiar with this area know about Hunter's Point. Hunter's Point, so you look at Hunter's Point, they have what? High crime rates, high unemployment, high poverty rates, et cetera, et cetera. You go to Knob Hill, it's like day and night, right? Better schooling, better policing, better recreational facilities, better health care, et cetera. So, you know, so the bottom line is that place does matter in terms of someone's well-being. So we need to always keep that in mind when we talk about reducing health disparities, because it's my premise. We have to look at socioeconomic status also, economic development, education. The higher the educational level that you attain, the most likely that you're going to be healthier. Earlier, I think somebody gave a definition of cultural competence. And, you know, this is some, but I'm looking at how do we define culturally linguistically appropriate services? And it really to synopsize this definition is talking about being respectful, responsive to the individual's cultural beliefs, health beliefs, how they view health in general. Taking into account language, health literacy is a big issue now, because even some of us who are so-called educated have problems understanding when a practitioner tells us you got to take this medication for this and what kind of medication you're talking about. You look at, like, you say once, you know, what does that mean? I mean, when you're dealing with, let's say, Spanish-speaking individuals, they say once, right? They may say once. Well, that means 11 times. So you got to think about those kind of issues. Another thing that we're talking about, the placenta. My oldest son was born in Oakland, Kaiser Permanente. And I remember when he came home, his umbilical cord, right? So after it fell off, what did I do with it? Anybody got an answer for that?
You buried it in the garden.
I buried it, that's right, in the backyard. And my wife said, what are you doing? But it was a cultural kind of practice that I acquired by my grandparents, you know. And so, you know, those little things that we just take for granted. Oh, yeah, the umbilical cord, boom. It goes into what, the medical disposal bag? You know, we gotta think about those kind of things in those kind of medical settings. So then, real quickly, the national plan standards. The original standards under 14 that were launched in the year 2000. And we went through a 3-year process in developing the class standards. So they didn't evolve by osmosis, you know. There was a process that we used. The three themes, culturally competent care, language access services, and organizational support. Yeah. I'm not going to go into detail because I don't have enough time to do that. So, we figured that after 10 years, it was time to revisit the standards. Right. Secondly, is with the whole movement of the Affordable Care Act. We were on almost the same train, same bullet train. And we wanted to make sure that we use that synergy, you know, that was going on when President Obama came on board. And so we launched this initiative. And this is the process that we went through in revisiting the 2000 iteration of the standards in terms of looking at literature, okay, the evolution of literature, the citations that have grown exponentially over the last 10 years, the number of citations, et cetera. And then we decided to have public comments. We posted an announcement in the Federal Register, so people go on the web, give us comments. We had an advisory committee composed of experts in the field who also gave us some input in terms of, looking at literature, looking at their research, the work they were doing in this area. The public comment period. We had a stakeholder meeting in San Francisco here, obviously, one in Chicago, and then one in Baltimore. So after all this information, we analyzed the data. We looked at where we could tweak the standards, seeking additional consultation from the advisory panel, and she says, "I only have 5 minutes." And then we did this whole analysis. Drafting, and then the idea is that hopefully for the next month or so we will launch the new enhanced class standards. What I'm giving you is just draft information because they hasn't been approved officially yet by headquarters at HHS. But one of the major goals, if you look at the 2000 standard, was to decrease healthcare disparities and make practices more culturally and linguistically appropriate. The new goal, the principal kind of driving force of the new enhanced standards, is to advance what? Health equity. And we heard a lot about that topic this morning from the previous panels. Improve quality. Tie in cultural competence into equity but quality. Okay, that will help eliminate health and healthcare disparities. And then one more, and then I'll go on. Culture. We expanded that definition to be more inclusive, okay, of geographic kind of areas, religion, spirituality, biological and sociological characteristics. So again, draft national class standards. Again, there's a principal standard that I mentioned earlier. The critical, I think, there's going to be 15, by the way, draft for the moment. I mean, that's the plan. But governance, leadership, and workforce are standards 3 to 4. And then you have communication language assistance, which basically those encompass, the language access standards that I talked about. And then the last, 9 through 15, engagement. How do you engage the public? How do you engage consumers to be part of this process, this movement? How do you look at continuous improvement kind of processes? How do you infuse cultural competency into the organizational culture? Accountability, who's accountable? Managers, leadership, et cetera. But again, I want to go back to governance because earlier I think there was some discussion about how do we make it happen? And it starts from the top. It starts from the top, but also there's from the bottom, there's a convergence. But if it doesn't start from the top, it ain't going to happen. Right? And also the importance of governance in terms of policy makers, the board. They're key kind of influencers that can make it happen, that can direct that CEO, that director to make it happen. Okay. So again, this is just a slide that gives you an idea in terms of, you know, the importance of governance, leadership, workforce. Workforce is so crucial. We know that minorities are severely underrepresented in the workforce. You look at nurses, registered nurses. You know, look at, if you look at the data, depending on what data you look at, it's either between 88% and 90% of registered nurses are Caucasian. And then you look at the demographics of this country, what, about 32% plus, you know, are composed of the major racial and ethnic group. There's a major disconnect there. Okay, so workforce is crucial in terms of increasing the representation of minorities in healthcare professions. Communication assistance, that's the one that we kind of changed the language, remember? Language access services, now it's communication and language assistance. You know, a lot has evolved since 2000. Social media, multimedia, Twitter, Facebook, you name it. So the technology has really expanded. With, you know, your iPhones. What is it, Siri? Some Siri? What is it, Siri? Siri? Of course, you know, she's not culturally appropriate sometimes. But, you know, that shows you how far technology has advanced. So we need to start using that kind of, those technology applications to promote language assistance for those language minorities that we're trying to reach. I already talked about this engagement, the importance of engagement, and you know, the public engagement. It's a big term. I think it's important that we start engaging the community or consumers in this process, because there is a movement in terms of what are we talking about? Patient-centered care. You know, how do you do that? You know, and it's a cultural thing, because number one, when I was growing up, there's three individuals I didn't question. Teacher, priest, and a doctor. God, doctors were like God, right? And these are cultural things we got to look at, you know, when we start trying to convince patients to be more engaged in that clinical process. Class, the importance of why are national class centers so important? Well, again, it goes back to quality services, offering a framework, a pathways for providing culturally competent care to diverse populations. There is some literature that, you know, that shows that it does build rapport and there is in a trusting kind of relationship with that practitioner. It does provide the ability to deliver personalized care, does improve adherence, does improve patient satisfaction. And these are all critical factors in advancing health equity and eliminating health disparities. And this gives you an idea in terms of what I'm talking about. Just kind of summarize that, you know, from the initial point of contact, you know, to the end point. Whatever, you know, sometimes patients may skip some of these kind of stages, but it's so important that, you know, cultural competency be looked at in every kind of service delivery kind of point. And if you get anything out of my presentation, go to this website. It's www.thinkculturalhealth.hhs.gov. We have a number of e-learning programs, cultural competency e-learning programs for physicians, nurses, first responders, and we're developing one for oral health professionals, and also developing one for promotoras de salud. And they're all, I would say, all the first three, and hopefully the remaining, they're all accredited for CME and continuing education, right? So that's the hook to get health professionals to take the course 24/7 free. You take the course, and you pass it, you get your certificate. You just print it off. Okay. So with that, I want to thank you, but interesting, somebody brought up the three cups of tea. It is so important that we recognize those cultural kind of nuances, because they do make a difference in terms of, you know, establishing that relationship with those patients, and I think that's what we're missing in terms of what's going on in Afghanistan and those other countries. And the military recognizes that, too, in terms of that cultural sensitivity that's needed. So with that, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Pachinko?
This question.
Yeah, hi. I work for the Department of Public Health in Los Angeles. Our program looks at health literacy, and the point of print materials and PowerPoints and so forth. And from your slide, and I saw written materials, and you can get into the issue between it's a cultural humility. Also, there's cultural sensitivity and cultural competency, but I don't want to get into those points. But getting the cultural competency where I guess you were looking at, you have to, it's a kind of a measure, but you're looking at a competency within those, on your website, on your material piece. See, what we're trying to do in our health literacy and the Department of Public Health is incorporate components. We're saying you should have a culturally appropriate photos and language, but there isn't a guideline exactly which types of components. And we got the issue is it's a big diverse population.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is, can you put together something that is generally, or is it there's ways of doing things that are community topic specific?
Well, you know, I'll try to answer it two ways. Number one is that when OMA started to develop this whole cultural competency agenda, it was like, are you going to just focus on Latinos, Blacks, Asians? No, I said, no. It's going to be a generalized kind of principles and concepts so that communities can adapt it or health professionals can adapt it to their own disciplines, their own respective communities. So more like a generalist kind of perspective. In terms of health literacy, you know, that is an evolving kind of discipline. You know, it's just taken off. And the literature is still being developed on it in terms of how we define it. What interventions do we use? For example, there's, what is that, the talk back or what, I forgot, the teach back or some concept. I would recommend that you go to the HHS. There's a website on health literacy. There's a health literacy action plan. And get some ideas in terms of, you know, what the federal government is pushing for this particular topic. The other thing is that, you know, what I always try to promote and push whenever I develop these e-learning programs is making sure that you use the right kind of methodology in terms of, for example, focus groups, in terms of these e-learning programs, I'm just using it as an analogy, do they really resonate with what we're trying to get across to health professionals? Because they give us that feedback. No, it doesn't make any sense. You need to do it this way. And I think that the same thing applies to as you develop, you know, these cultural competency or social marketing materials for your respective communities, is to test those products, but also work hand in hand with them, maybe at the initial stages, so that at the end of the day, you're not going to be spending a lot of money in terms of, okay, here's the product, focus group, wait, boom, got to come back and revise it. You know, start at the beginning to work with communities to look at health literacy issues, to look at cultural competency kind of concepts that do resonate with their respective communities.
Because I can only tell you, I don't know if it's competition because we have 26 languages.
And I know.
26, we have 10 top languages, and then we have 4,000 employees that we tell people this is the way, but I can't say, are you going to be using it in community X? Why?
Yeah.
That's
a challenge. Olivia?
Hi, I'm Olivia Carter Fokris from the University of Maryland College Park, and we've been working together with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene in the state of Maryland to develop a resource guide of bringing resources, educational resources, because we recognize a lot of people are trying to implement new standards and new education and training, but there's a lot of resources. Both.
I just want to make one more pitch for HRSA, Health Resources Service Administration, because they've done a lot of work in the area of health literacy and communication. So go to their website. Great resources. They have videos, vignettes, etc. So thank you again.